Mother's Day is almost here, and you can get her the most beautiful time-tested gift around. A watch she can wear every day for Movement. Whether mom's into classic dress watches, rare and refined ceramics, or tried-and-true bestsellers, Movement has something she'll love. And right now, you can save big on the best Mother's Day gift ever with up to 50% off site-wide during Movement's Mother's Day sale at MVMT.com. Again, that's up to 50% off at MVMT.com.
Hi, this is Martin Fowler, and you're listening to The Agile Uprising.
Hello, and welcome to another edition of The Agile Uprising podcast. I am your host, Troy Lightfoot. And with me, I have two very special guests, Pratik and Dan from ProKanban.org. Hey guys, how you doing?
That's at least one special guest, right? Yeah, we're not going to tell you which one is special. Yeah.
So also hosts of their own podcast, video channel, Drunk Agile. So probably the best Agile-related thing on YouTube. Not probably, it is. I mean, let's be honest. So yeah, so it's an awesome channel. I love it, and if you're a geek like me about this kind of stuff, you probably would love it too. So we'll put that in the show notes. And guys, do you want to give just a very brief introduction? So there, in case there are people who aren't aware of who you are, we can just start with that, and then we can go right into it.
Yeah, Pratik, you go first.
Yeah, that's that. So our introduction is that we keep waiting for the other person to go first. I'm Pratik Singh. I have been doing software development and software development related activities for the past two decades or so, and started off as a developer and now help people understand flow and lean principles so that they can do software development or product development of any kind better.
Mm-hmm. Right. Thanks, Pratik. And how about you, Dan?
Been doing Agile for just way too long. I'm not going to say how long, but it's a long time. Maybe longer than the age of many of your listeners, probably. I guess my claim to fame is I was on the world's first Kanban team. We weren't calling it Kanban at the time, but then it came to be known as, you know, as Kanban and the practices that we're using. So I've been doing Kanban ever since. Around about the early 2010, probably right around 2010, is when I shifted to really kind of focus more on the metrics and analytics side. Published the first book, you know, a couple years later, published my second book a couple years after that, and then published my third book a couple years after that. So here I am.
Awesome. Well, thank you, Dan. And so in the show notes, I will put a video of Dan talking about the secret history of Kanban. And so if you want to know more about that, you can find out about that. How about that? All right. Well, thanks guys. I'm really excited. We Agile Uprising had a podcast with you, Dan, years ago, about your first actionable Agile metrics for predictability book. I wasn't on that, but I was an AU member at the time. So I'm glad to be doing this one. I recently read the book this week, so it's all fresh in my mind. Full transparency for the listeners. I am a ProKanban.org trainer. So I do have a relationship with that organization and these guys. So I should just be transparent about that. So you know that. All right. Well, thanks. So let's talk about the book, Dan. So my question was, out of all the things you could have written about right now in this day and age in 2023, why this book and why now? Why the subject of this book in particular?
A couple of reasons for that. It's been about 10 years since I've started writing the first one. So I think I started writing the first one about 2013. And when I published that first book, there was a bunch of stuff that I wanted to write about that it's not that I couldn't, but that first book is kind of dense, kind of boring, and kind of long to begin with, you know? And so there was a bunch of stuff that I wanted to put in that, you know, I just couldn't. And so I had originally thought about doing two things. One, publishing a second edition of the first book, And then two, doing a blog series on all the stuff that I wished I could have put in the first book. Well, when I started down that path, the second edition of the first book just seemed like way too much work. And then the blog series that I thought about doing, it ended up that there was enough material there for a book in its own right. So I was like, you know what? What the heck? I'll just I'll just do a whole book. So I don't know how exciting that is, but that's the backstory.
Okay. And the book is largely about variation, randomness, and a predictable process. That's kind of what I was summarizing it. There's also things about Monte Carlo and scale Monte Carlo in there, but I would say the majority of the book is about process behavior charts, variation, randomness. So my follow-up to my first question was, why that topic now? Like, why do you think that's so important? That was on your mind for probably the last few years to really bring to the audience.
Yeah, because I mean, it felt like the right evolution. So where the first book was about what data to capture and how to calculate flow metrics from that data. I did some basic analysis. I talked about some basic analysis, but really it was about what data should you be tracking and how to calculate flow metrics for predictability. The second book was about, okay, now that you're calculating flow metrics properly, how do you take those flow metrics and how do you turn them into meaningful probabilistic forecasts about the future? Mm-hmm. So now that hopefully everybody understands that, which of course we know that not everybody understands that, now it's more about, okay, well, you've got all the data, you've got all the techniques to turn the data into a forecast. Let's now do some meaningful forecasts around, or sorry, some meaningful analysis around the data itself. And are you really running a predictable process? I mean, is the data that's coming off of your process, you know, signaling that there's something wrong, signaling that there's a change, or, you know, are you really safe to do some of the more advanced Monte Carlo techniques that you're right, I talk about in kind of the last third of the book. So I mean, it's just kind of a nice evolution for you know, how we talk about this stuff.
Okay, awesome. When it comes to a predictable process, one in the audience might wonder, why is that so important? Why should I care so much about that?
Because your customers do, period.
Right, sure. sure.
You know? Sure. Yeah. We talk, Pratik and I, whenever we give a class, we always ask that question. It's like, once you start on work for your customers, what's the very first question they're going to ask you? And the very first question they ask you is going to be, when will it be done?
Right.
And a lot of people think when will it be done is all about, it's all about planning. It's all about estimation. It's all about even Monte Carlo simulation, right? That's what they think answering when will it be done is all about. And right. It has almost nothing to do with any of those things. Mm. It's about this other stuff. It's about, you know, how you operate your process every day, the policies that you have in place, you know, how are you making improvements? You know, it's the sentence I steal from my friend Ben Ballard all the time. It's like, predictability is a verb. It's not this thing you attain. It's the little things that you do every single day that you think have nothing to do with predictability,
right?
Have everything to do with predictability.
Right. And one of the, you know, great things about your book, and I believe this language comes from Sheward actually. And you know, mentioning in your book, and you were summarizing it very easy to understand. And that's talking about the concept of the voice of the customer and the voice of the process and aligning those things. And that's kind of why predictability is so important. Do you maybe want to talk about those two things?
Yeah. And that's where we were talking before we went on air. That's kind of where my frustration with things like Scrum and Safe boil over. Mm-hmm. Because these agile frameworks out there, they want to give you this template and they say, hey, regardless of your system, regardless of your context, regardless of what you're doing, you have to be able to deliver in 30 days or less. Right.
Right.
That's a specification. It's nice to want those things, right? But just because you want those things doesn't mean that you can design a system to be able to do that. And that's where the data side comes in. So I'm not saying that, you know, being able to deliver in 30 days or less is a bad thing. I'm not saying that at all. What I am saying is that setting that goal arbitrarily and independent of any data that you collect off your process, because it's so the specification is the voice of the customer. The data that you have coming off your process is the voice of your process. That's your process telling you, okay, this is what we're truly capable of. Mm-hmm. And I can't tell you, I think every agile team that I've been on, those two voices have been out of sync.
Yep.
Right.
Go ahead. I was going to say, it's hard to say you're predictable if those two things aren't aligned, right?
Exactly.
Right. makes a lot of sense to me. So if you're confused about that and you're listening, one, number one, read Dan's book. That's one thing. Number two, go back and read. In fact, the first time I heard about this was from Dr. Wheeler in a book I read called Understanding Variation. Anyway, and he talks about that in there as well. So this is a really a fundamental thing to understand for predictability and making your customers happy as well, right? And process improvement. Okay, so Dan, you know, you mentioned in your book and other talks about the two mistakes, and you have a you kind of a famous talk about Wilt Chamberlain that you did on YouTube about that and things like that. So maybe we can just talk briefly about that to the audience. Why is it so critical to not make the two mistakes, and what are those two mistakes?
Well, I mean, if you don't mind, I tweak your language a little bit. It's impossible to never. To never not make the mistakes. Did I say
that? I
said
that. Okay. Right. Okay. Right. Okay.
The best you can do is have an indication whether you are not making, you know, it's like that you're probably making a mistake, but you don't know for sure. It's impossible to.
Okay.
And that's for sure at all. And so the first mistake is mistaking a signal for noise. Mm-hmm. You know, we see this all the time. This is, I think in the book, I go into the example, you know, if you're doing Scrum, like I said, you set a sprint length for yourself of 14 days mm-hmm. and, oh, you know, we don't get all our work done within those 14 days. And so we think there's something wrong. We go into our retrospective and we say, oh, there's something wrong with our process. You know, we got to do something. We got to fix it or whatever. Most likely that's mistaking signal for noise. The fact that you missed your sprint boundary probably has almost nothing to do with what your process is capable of.
Right.
So we can go deeper into that if everybody wants to. And then the second one is the opposite of that, mistaking noise for signal. So,
yeah. Okay. This is the Scrum piece of this is very interesting, right? Because obviously Scrum is the most used agile framework in the world, right? And I think this fundamental kind of misunderstanding about natural variation permeates every organization I've ever seen using Scrum personally, right? that you think you can control the variation by setting a time box. Or picking a specification. Mm-hmm. So for the listeners out there, Dan dives into this pretty well, or very well, actually, in his new book. So definitely read that. All right, cool. Thanks, Dan, for that one. A lot of the book is about something called a process behavior chart, and some people, and Shure himself, originally called a control chart. Mm-hmm. So maybe I was thinking, what's a process? Just simply so that, because obviously a lot of people listening probably haven't read your book yet. What is a process behavior chart, and what's the difference between that and a control chart?
So a process behavior chart is, I think, exactly what you just said. It's just a way. It's a nice visualization of the variation in your process. Mm-hmm. And using a process behavior chart, you can tell the capability of your process. You can tell whether it's potentially predictable or not. Things like that. Just a very, very nice, clean visualization of variation of your data. Mm-hmm. The difference between that and a control chart. So a process behavior chart is what Shure intended control charts to be. However, as with anything, right? When Shure's ideas got out into the wild, they got misunderstood, they got perverted. The Six Sigma crew moved in and took over stuff and just completely, I don't want to say ignored because it's more evil than that. They just completely abandoned the Shure approach. The way that limits are to be calculated, the way that data should be interpreted and things like that. So what people, you know, nowadays, because of Six Sigma and all the Six Sigma training, what people consider control charts or what people call control charts have nothing to do with what Shure intended, which is why Dr. Wheeler and his contemporaries got together and said, okay, if we want to continue in the Shure tradition, we're going to need a different name because we've lost the control chart naming battle. And so that's why I think it was in the late 90s, early 2000s, they said, okay, we're going to call it a process behavior chart. And they're going to make it, they made it, you know, I think the name's a lot more descriptive. It's mm-hmm. not necessarily about controlling variation. It's about understanding the behavior of your process and what you can do about it.
That's great. And I was reading, like anything, right? When I'm learning things or trying to explain things to other people, I'm trying to say, what's the counter argument to this, right? So I kind of went searching for counter arguments, actually. I found some, like anything. Mm-hmm. And some people are very defensive in the Six Sigma community about this. And they say, well, we've been doing this stuff for a long time, you know, at companies, and it's worked for us, right? So what would, I guess, what's Wheeler, what's your kind of rebuttal to that, if you have one, of why you shouldn't use the Six Sigma approach to a control chart?
Because it inflates your chances of making one of those two mistakes, right?
Okay,
the way that they, there is a reason that Shewhart gave the mathematics that he did around drawing the limits around your data. There's reasons for that. And if you draw those limits wrong, incorrectly, you are almost certainly significantly, not just by a little bit, but significantly increasing your chances of making one of those two mistakes, which pretty much obviates the whole reason for using control charts to begin with.
Right.
Yeah.
All right. Here's what I was hoping to get from your perspective. Use cases. So obviously there's one use case for flow metrics, and a lot of your book is about that. How about some non-agile metric use cases where you could say, you know what, the same stuff that you can read in my book exactly, and you can use the chart, learn how to build it yourself, learn how to use it. You could use it also in these areas, and it could be very helpful. Do you have any use cases outside of the Agile space that you could think of for that?
I mean, pretty much any data that you see presented anywhere is probably. Yeah. Dr. Wheeler gives a couple. He talks about using this data as not necessarily proof, but a characterization of climate change. You know, he uses data to track hurricane activity over the past however many hundred years. And he shows how, you know, in a process behavior chart, you can actually see, you know, the changes that way. The inspiration for the talk that I did at Agile, whatever it was, you know, changes in the number of teens who smoke. You know,
right.
A lot of people think that there is signal in terms of, hey, you know, the number of teens who smoke have gone up, when if you look at the data, it's just buried in the noise. The number of traffic deaths there are every year looks like it's gone up. It's just in the noise. And so pretty much anytime somebody presents some data and they want to make, you know, they want to come to a conclusion, they want to present, you know, a finding based on that data, you know, the check against that is a process behavior chart.
And I think, thanks. And one thing that we've been using it for is for product management. So often when you're trying to come up with an idea, you say, okay, I have a hypothesis. This thing is going to work or it might not work. And here's how we're going to test that hypothesis. You put some data together, right? How do you know that data has actually moved the needle enough to make a decision based off of, right? And if you have a normal range of variability and you're introducing an idea, she's saying, well, it's supposed to move out of this normal range to show it has some significance to it. Otherwise, how can we even know that it worked, right? And so you can use a process behavior chart to do that type of analysis too, right?
Yeah,
any type of data analysis. Yeah.
Yeah. And I'm already starting to see this in some of the comments of the people who read the book, but honestly, and it's just reminiscent of Little's Law too. Mm-hmm. My belief is the way this stuff should be used is more qualitatively than quantitatively. So many people are worried about how do I calculate limits exactly? And how do I detect signals exactly based on those exact, that's not really what I care about. What I care about is people understanding that variation is intrinsic to your process. In fact, I think the sentence I use in the book is your process is variation. Mm. And so you have to expect that there's going to be changes in your data. And when you get a change in your data, your expectation should be, that's just noise. That's just down in the noise.
Right.
You know, unless you have real good reason to think otherwise, and over 99% of the time, you won't have that good reason.
Right.
It's just noise, you know,
right.
and you're getting yourself worked up and you're probably changing things and probably making things worse by reacting to noise. And so that's really how I want people thinking about this.
Gotcha. Okay. Awesome. So summarize that conversation. You can really use it for anything, any kind of data analysis you need to do, right? And product development is obviously a great use case for that.
Yep.
How about, you know, in your first book, you talk a lot about scatter plots.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, in the Applying Metrics for Predictability class that we have in ProCom.org, we talk about signal and noise visualizing in a scatter plot.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess my question is, scatter plots versus process behavior charts, what are your thoughts about someone that is just using a scatter plot for that versus actually using a real process behavior? What if they have a tool which it has built-in scatter plot but doesn't have the process behavior chart? Is one good enough, or should they definitely use the process behavior chart?
So both and.
Okay.
Okay. So I thought I touched on this in the book. I might not have. I meant to. If I didn't, so if I didn't, I'll probably need to go back and put this in. Mm-hmm. But there is absolutely space for both. Just because you have a process behavior chart doesn't mean that it obviates the need for a scatter plot. Because right. we talk about variation in the class that you're mentioning, mm-hmm. and we look at a scatter plot again, it's more qualitative. It's like generally right. speaking, your signal is going to be way up here on mm-hmm. your scatter plot, and your noise is going to be down here. You know, but we don't talk about a rigorous mathematical definition of that. Plus, the scatter plot's more about things like calculating a service level expectation, setting, you know, being able to segment your data, you know, in terms of the risk of certain outcomes. For me, that's what the scatter plot's all about, is understanding the risk associated with certain outcomes. And so how do we make plans based on our understanding of that segmentation of risk? The process behavior chart is more about understanding, has our process changed? You know, did we make a change? And like you said, did it move the needle? Did something else happen in the world and that has moved the needle? Right. So I think they have, you know, two distinct reasons for existence. And so I would say you use both. If you're just using a scatter plot right now, I think most of the time in our world, a scatter plot probably is good enough. I don't know that you necessarily need a process behavior chart. But if you really want to get good about predictability and you want to be confident in being able to say, yes, our process is predictable or no, our process is not predictable, then yeah, you're going to have to, you have to go that step further and right. go to the process behavior chart.
So just to be clear, Dan, I'm pretty sure you do mention your book, but the questions I put together are what I think people would ask.
Yeah. So, no, you're catching me off guard because I'm like, I don't know. Did I say this? What do I know? Right. I'm just kind of making this up as I go along.
All right. Fair enough. All right, cool. All right. So, and I'm just thinking of my students who've went through one of my courses. Like, I teach that class a lot, actually my favorite class to teach. So, and I know that that's probably a question they would ask if I introduced process behavior chart. Okay, now let's talk about flow metrics and process behavior charts. So in your book, you talk about the four major flow metrics, and you mentioned that there are two which are probably best used for process behavior charts, which are work item age and cycle time.
Mm-hmm.
And so I guess if you have a work item age chart, right? Now, I mean, I know the answer to this, but I'm just curious for yours. If you have a work item age chart and you're already using that, right? Why would you want to use work item age in a process behavior chart?
Well, this is why I would love to bring Pratik into this. I'm putting him on the spot because in our conversations, Pratik came up with what I think is from a process behavior chart perspective, a much better formulation for the use of age. So I don't know, Pratik, do you want to talk about that? Because I think this is, we haven't really mentioned this much in anything, but it's in the book. So I don't know if you want to go ahead.
So now people know about it.
Yeah.
I think this was just to put some context around, I think it's 2016, 2017, when we first started discussing this thing called total age. And we kind of talked about it and then we're like, this is too complex to explain right now. Let's just put it aside. And then we came back to it a few years later. And the whole idea of a total age is, I'm guessing people are familiar with work item age. If you're not, read Dan's book. Mm-hmm. But the idea of a total age is you take the age of every item that's active with you right now and sum it up to find out how many days you have invested but not gotten a return. How many item days, essentially, have you invested? So that's total age. That is that for every day you have a particular number for that total age. It's essentially time series data. You can capture it every day and see what the total age is every day. If you put that in as Dan described, if you put that in the process behavior chart, you can find out what are the limits within which your team usually operates. What is the how much total age do they carry on a daily basis? Now we can start talking about, is the total age gone too far up? Is the total age dropping too much? And when it gets outside those control limits, or potentially just before it gets outside those control limits, we can start having the right conversations of, hey, it really looks like we should finish something today and definitely not start anything new today because our total age will go out of control. or yeah. our total age is going to go out of control. If we finish something, we should really be starting something very soon.
Awesome. If for anybody who's listened to our previous episode called We're All Wrong About Little's Law, which is the episode I recorded with Andy Clef, you might, or if you've read any Dan's work, you might know about the, or read Dr. Little's white paper, you might know about the Little's Law assumptions, right? And one of them is about the average WIP age basically staying the same. And so obviously in your book, you talk about average WIP age versus total WIP age, and you recommend using the total WIP age, right, for that. And because of the way averages work, they're based off of a total anyway, right? So if you can keep, what I think you're saying, Pratik, is if you can keep that total age within that range, right, then that will help you be more predictable, and that will obviously help you with one of the underlying assumptions for Little's Law.
I saw Dan almost jump out of his skin there.
Yeah, I just wanted to make sure. Yeah. No. So when we say the preference for total WIP age over average WIP age is when it's in the context of a process behavior chart.
Yes.
Because one of the problems with plotting average age, not that you can't do it, but one of the problems with plotting average WIP age on a process behavior chart is then you're taking an average of an average,
right?
Know, to do those calculations, and things start to get funky. You know, it's like you kind of get to the nexus of the universe, and you know, bad things just start to happen. Which is why the total age, I think, is a much more tangible tangible metric that we can look at. And it gives you multiple, as Pratik was saying, it gives you multiple dimensions that you can. You don't like your total WIP age? Well, then quit starting stuff, right?
I mean,
if you don't have as much stuff in progress, your total WIP age is probably going to go down.
Right.
You don't like your total WIP age? Okay, focus on the thing that is, you know, the oldest thing. So, you know, you've got several lines of attack by looking at total WIP. So, yeah. So I just wanted to make sure.
Yeah.
From a process behavior chart, that's why there might be a slight preference to total WIP age.
Okay. Yeah, cool.
If you take that line of logic a little further, it's like the reason we're talking total WIP age is, if you have, let's say you usually get things done in 10 days or less, but you have one item that's 100 days old, and you want to bring the average age down. The easiest way to bring the average age down is to start 10 new items.
Right. Gotcha.
Right. Not that people will be nefarious enough to do that, but essentially sometimes bad behavior gets hidden in average. It'll show up later because you'll violate some other Little's Law option.
Right.
Yeah.
Awesome. In your book, Dan, in your first book, you briefly talk about Monte Carlo simulations and probabilistic forecasting. In your second book, that's pretty much what it's all about.
Mm-hmm.
So in this one, you go into more details about it, as well as talk about scaling.
Mm-hmm.
Is there anything you'd like to audit? So I'm guessing people listening to this, some people are familiar with this technique, some people aren't. So it's probably a range of information out there. Let's go with the people who aren't that familiar with it. Why should they care, whether it's Monte Carlo or single item forecast, about using a probabilistic forecast for product development?
Getting back to the statement I said before, that you know, all processes variation, and that's the way uncertainty manifests itself in our world and our data, is by these changes in each data point that we collect.
Mm-hmm.
So because what we do is uncertain, you know, anytime uncertainty is, you know, a part of your process, there's a whole mathematics, there's a whole science around uncertainty, and that is called probability. And so if what you do is in any way uncertain, that demands it's not a polite request, right? Mm-hmm. It's not a, oh, by the way, maybe consider this.
Right.
It demands that you take a probabilistic approach, because, you know, trying to take a deterministic one will always end in disaster.
Right.
At some point. So yeah, that's why you should care. And, you know, everybody loves to talk about complex product development. I'm not a big believer in debates, you know, about the Kinevin model, the Stacey model. I don't care if it's complex or simple, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
The thing that's common to all of them is there is uncertainty, right?
Sure.
And so that demands a probabilistic approach.
Yeah. Okay. So the main one you talk about in your book is the Monte Carlo simulations. Again, but this time it seemed more focused on Monte Carlo at scale. So for those who might have played around with Monte Carlo for their team, for their Agile team or anything like that, any advice you might give them for doing this at scale? Obviously read the book, but any just short-term advice?
Well, and so this is, I mean, so the reason you bring both of us on this, and I think all of your listeners probably know this by now, is I don't answer hard questions. I just, kind of put them over. And in full transparency, when you get to the Monte Carlo at scale chapters, I've stolen most, if not all, of stuff that Pratik has written, because he went out and did the hard work of actually performing the simulations and kind of figuring this stuff out. I maybe tell some nice stories around it, but the actual hard work is what Pratik did. So, Pratik, do you want to talk about, since it's your work, do you want to talk about gotchas of Monte Carlo at scale? Because I think that's the world that most people are going to find themselves is how do we do Monte Carlo at scale? So
Yeah, well, tips, tricks, anything you got, things to look out for?
Yeah, there. I'm going to roll this back.
Okay.
The base point of Monte Carlo is pretending that we're running the project through and figuring out how long it took us to run that project, or we're running the next 30 days and figuring out what we got done there. When we say we are running the next 30 days, what we're saying is we are operating our system, pretending that we're operating our system for the next 30 days and what we got done. The next question is, what is a system?
Yeah.
if that's what we're doing. Mm-hmm. If that system is a whole bunch of teams that are interdependent, well, now we need to model that interdependency into that Monte Carlo. We need to figure out what happens as those things are dependent on each other.
Yeah.
If that system is a single team working on multiple features at the same time, well, we need to figure out how many features are they working on and run the next 30 days as if they're working on all those features. And when they finish a feature, they start another feature.
Mm-hmm.
If it is the multiple teams working on separate stuff, well, then we run them separately and we roll them up into a single view.
Mm.
It's essentially the very basis of Monte Carlo is figuring out how the next X number of days will go, or what will happen next. So any dependencies that you have, any higher level WIP that you have, all those things should get factored into that Monte Carlo. So far for a team, when Dan's talked about team and I've talked about team Monte Carlo, team level, single story Monte Carlo, it's been pretty straightforward. Get the throughput, push it through. Now that we're adding organizational dependencies and all that stuff in it, well, we got to model that stuff in.
Sure, that makes sense. Okay. One of the big questions that I actually ran a workshop this week about this topic, a process behavior chart topic, and it was all about for product metrics, actually. That's what it was about. And the questions I got were, well, what's the tooling for this? Like, how do we build this into our tooling? So I said, well, okay, I will build you an Excel sheet. I'll give you that. And you can play around with it. You can put real stuff in there. But they said, yeah, but a lot of our product metrics are automated and we have the tooling for that and we use Power BI and blah, blah, blah. So I said, okay. So I did some research and it looks like there is a Power BI plugin for this. But I just wanted to open up to you guys. First, for flow metrics, what are the tooling options? And then outside of flow metrics, to your knowledge, what are the different kind of things people could do?
Well, for flow metrics, there's only one tool, that's called Actionable Agile. I mean, I say that facetiously, but I also say it kind of seriously because one of the reasons that we built Actionable Agile was because there was no flow metrics tool out there. Even the tools out there that say that they do flow metrics, generally speaking, do flow metrics wrong. So, for flow metrics, Actionable Agile. For process behavior charts, again, it's one of those things you have to be really, really careful that you're not getting a Six Sigma process behavior, Six Sigma control chart. A great example of this is a lot of people say, oh, look, Jira has something called a control chart.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what that thing is, but I can tell you what exactly it's not, and it's not a control chart. So that's where you have to be really, really careful when these software packages come to you and they say, oh, look at our pretty flow metrics, look at our pretty control charts. Unless you really kind of understand what you're looking at, you know, they'll end up making fools out of both of us, which is one of the reasons why we wrote the book. Shameless plug. Hopefully, you know, early next year, coming to a useful tool near you. You know, all the process behaviors chart stuff will be in there. But yeah, for software, I know, Pratik, I don't know if you can add anything to the software. It's just, I think it's just there's a dearth of options, really.
Yeah. I would actually, from the Monte Carlo perspective, that alongside Actionable Agile is also a portfolio forecaster, which does some of the scaled forecasting as well, which also is by 55 degrees will do Actionable Agile. I don't know of many other tools. Most of the time when Dan and I have had to do this, we've built it ourselves.
Right.
if it's beyond the capabilities of Actionable Agile, yeah.
I did find, it seems like, I mean, I haven't played around with it. I just was doing some research. One for a plugin for Power BI, which it does seem like it's using the right limits. It does seem like it's, at least from the material I read. Oh, I'm happy to send it to you. And I can put it even in the description of this podcast. Dan, so I've been playing around. Obviously, I'm a user of Actionable Agile for years now. And I've been playing around in their labs version, and they do have a process behavior chart for that. And I believe it's for cycle time, at least the one I used. Mm-hmm. Is there plans for having a total WIP age as well for that?
Yes. Okay.
Gotcha.
Yes.
Okay. And you're thinking it's early next year. Is that correct?
Yep.
Okay. All right. Is that a deterministic or a probabilistic forecast? No, I'm just kidding. All right. Yes. Anyway. All right. Fair enough. Early next year. That's a good thing. Well, folks who are listening, I'm going to link you the Excel sheet that I built. If you want to play around with this on your own, just kind of experiment with some stuff, you can do that. For Dan and Pratik, any last words, anything you gentlemen want to plug? The floor is yours.
I mean, Pratik just... that kind of marries everything that we've talked about. Pratik just published a book on scaling. So,
okay.
Talk a little bit about that,
Pratik? I'll link it in the chat. Pratik, why don't you give a plug for that? Because Pratik and I are going to, and Dan, we would love to have you on that too. Yeah. We're going to record a podcast in a couple of weeks about that book.
Okay.
So that's the plan. But Pratik, go ahead. Tell us about your book as a primer. Yeah, as a primer.
Yeah,
go
yeah,
ahead.
It's a primer. Yeah. It's a... Over the past few years, I've seen scaling become this weird thing which requires train or flight.
Right.
When Dan and I have done this in the past, we've kept it very simple, and we feel like we've been successful keeping it simple. So that's why the book is Scaling Simplified. And it just talks about a very, very simple approach to scaling, regardless of what you're doing right now. You should be able to simplify what you're doing and actually get back to doing work rather than sitting in planning meetings.
Gotcha. Okay. So for the listeners out there, expect a podcast about that book, How to Simplify Scaling. That'll be pretty cool. Before I say my last word, any other things you want to plug? How about Pro Kanban or anything like that?
What? Who? hopefully if you're listening to this podcast or interested in Flow, and if you're interested in Flow, we hope that you've heard of Pro Kanban. So, for us, ProKanban.org is a community based around this idea that there needs to be a safe, diverse, inclusive environment where people can learn about all the things that we're talking about on this show. For the longest time, Kanban has not had that kind of safe space to be able to do this stuff. And we hope with Pro Kanban that we can provide that space for the community and by extension, make us all better.
Thank you guys. I really appreciate your time. And this should be out this week. So looking forward to it.
Thanks for having us, Troy. I was really, really glad to be here. Thanks for not asking too tough of questions. Making us look kind of good. And and thanks to all the listeners for listening. We really appreciate you investing some time learning about some crazy variation stuff.
There we go. Thank you.
Hope we can do it again soon.
Thank you.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.